Our first case of the morning is number 023043, Deborah Cullen against the Indiana University Board of Trustees. Mr. Fox.
Good morning, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Ryan Fox, and I represent the appellant, Dr. Deborah Cullen, in her appeal from the District Court entry of summary judgment in favor of IUPUI regarding her claims under the Equal Pay Act and Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. There are numerous genuine issues of material fact in this case based on the evidence in the record. Thus, this is a case that needs to be tried by the jury. This case arose after a pay equity study was conducted by IUPUI, in which the study concluded that there is a statistically significant gap between the amount of pay male professors made to their female counterparts. Specifically, this gap was most significant in the terms of full professors between males and females. Dr. Cullen was identified as a person. There was more than one standard deviation below the predicted salary pursuant to this study, and thus was identified as an outlier. After discovery, Dr. Cullen was able to also establish that there was a specific male individual who could be used as her comparator. That male comparator is Dr. Sandy Quillen, who is an associate professor for the department for the program of physical therapy. Dr. Cullen is a full professor.
All these cases are very, very fact specific. And it struck me as pretty unusual here that Quillen, who is your comparable, replaced a female professor who was making $23,000 a year more than Dr. Cullen. So when he came into that department, which is a different department, I would expect it's natural that he's going to be paid at least as much as his predecessor in that job. And I've not seen any cases, maybe you can help me find some, that have a similar situation. That strikes me as rather unusual.
Well, Your Honor, if there are some facts that are different in this case. First of all, it is undisputed that Dr. Cullen was paid more than the female predecessor. Secondly, in terms of the budget and the allocation of resources, Dean Saltzman, who is the supervisor for both Dr. Cullen and Dr. Quillen, testified that in the mid-1990s, the physical therapy program brought in outside funding. Dean Saltzman testified that one of the things the program directors were encouraged to do was to bring in this outside funding. And in fact, Dr. Cullen had brought in $150,000 per year from Clarion Health. Dean Saltzman testified in his deposition that similar funding was also brought in by Quillen's predecessor. Dean Saltzman did not hire Dr. Quillen's predecessor. He was not the dean at the time. And the fact still remains that Dr. Quillen was paid more than the predecessor. I believe it was approximately around $4,000. Further, one of the things that IUPUI argues is that market salary somehow was the reason that Dr. Quillen had to be paid such a high salary. And if you look at the letter that Dean Saltzman sent to the Affirmative Action Committee after Dr. Quillen had filed her charge of discrimination, you will see that the market salary for program directors of physical therapy was in fact he was paying $17,000 more than that market salary.
But this was a department that was sort of in trouble, wasn't it? Wasn't he hired to sort of save that department, which was apparently a more important department from a revenue-producing point of view?
IEPOI argues that this program had accreditation problems. We don't deny that the level of degrees that became necessary for a physical to become a physical therapist one had to attain. However, in terms of the actual duties or responsibilities, the additional responsibilities that Quillen had to perform, that is not exactly clear, because the School of Allied Health Sciences basically had to send a letter to all the students, which was actually the dean's responsibility, and nowhere was it Dr. Quillen's responsibility. Moreover, when you look at different programs, and here we're looking at the School of Allied Health Sciences, and they have 12 different programs within the school. And Dean Salkman testified that the job descriptions were identical for Dr. Quillen and Dr. Quillen. And I know that there's case law out there that says, well, it's not all about job descriptions, but it is about responsibility. And Dean Salkman's deposition is clear that in terms of responsibilities, every program director had certain responsibilities, whether it be for establishing new curriculum, making sure that they were up to date on accreditation. And it is safe to assume here that when you're working with a university, courses change, coursework change, technology changes. And so, but those responsibilities still remain the same. And not to say that there's going to be some additional responsibilities in one area or not some additional responsibilities in the other area. What the district court also ignored were Quillen's accomplishments. Dr. Quillen's accomplishments, first of all, she was a full professor. And there are rigorous standards between full professors and associate professors that is through IUPUI. For example, one of the things in looking that the district court found in looking at Quillen's salary and saying, well, it seems to me that the market factors for respiratory therapists were lower, was that after Dr. Quillen was identified as an outlier, someone that needed to be reviewed by her peers, Dean Salkman attached salary reviews for similarly respiratory therapy program directors and full professors throughout the country. And if you look at those figures, you'll see that the average respiratory therapist program director that was a full professor in 1998 made approximately $72,000, and in 1999 made approximately $75,000, which is the exact same market survey that Dean Salkman provided to the Affirmative Action Committee with regards to Dr. Quillen. The only difference is that Dr. Quillen was an associate professor and Dr. Quillen is a full professor. So I would argue that the market salaries between those are in fact substantially similar, and that in fact the Dean of Allied Health Sciences study that was later used is more of a post hoc rationalization by IUPUI, because in that study they don't have full professor respiratory therapists to show how much they made. And that's what Dr. Quillen was. The district court held that although the basic dimensions of their jobs are similar, Quillen had additional responsibilities which made his job substantially different than Quillen's, and that the defendant used a number of factors other than sex to explain this disparity. And the court kind of combined many of these at the district court level. But one of the things that they looked at was, well, Dr. Quillen's program has more faculty, it has more students, and it has more credit. But if you look at the School of Allied Health Sciences as a whole, you will see that the Radiological Science Department in 1999 had more faculty than the Physical Therapy Department. And it also was second in terms of the number of students, in fact only two less. In terms of professional credit, it was second highest out of the schools of Allied Health Sciences. So you would assume, based on IUPUI's argument, that the pay for the radiological sciences program director would be somewhat similar to that of the physical therapy program director. But the truth is that she was the lowest paid out of all of the program directors in the School of Allied Health Sciences. So we believe that creates a genuine issue of fact in terms of having somehow more additional responsibilities when the radiological science program director was the lowest paid in the department. The court also looked at, obviously, the market factor in terms of, well, we had to bring Dr. Quillen in. And at the same time, in terms of physical therapists, they also hired a physical therapist assistant clinical professor, and there was two other physical professors also in physical therapy. All of these individuals were being paid less than the average salary for a physical therapist from the survey that IUPUI used. For example, Mary Carey, who was hired at the same time as Dr. Quillen, is a physical therapy clinical assistant professor, and she was paid only $47,610 in 1999, while the average at that time was $58,305. Additionally, if you look at the figures for the average salary for program directors of physical therapy from 1998 to 1999, the market actually decreased in terms of the average salary was $79,000 and went down to $75,000
for Dr. Fox, if I could maybe redirect the discussion slightly. You mentioned earlier this pay equity study. And in your brief, you say that the pay equity study is relevant because, in fact, you have identified a person with comparable responsibilities, Dr. Quinlan. Suppose we were to disagree with you about as to whether Dr. Quinlan is, in fact, a person with comparable responsibilities. Assuming we disagree with you on that, what role, if any, could the pay equity study have in your case?
I believe, Your Honor, that the pay equity study alone creates a genuine issue of material fact in this case. And I say that because the pay equity study was one in which the authors of the study took into account legal pitfalls. They looked at previous case law. Unlike the Rudeburs case, they had factors that controlled for merit. They had factors that controlled for productivity. They had factors that controlled for the different schools that one is. For obviously, someone's an economics professor compared to another department or another program within the school. They controlled for all those, and Dr. Coleman was identified as someone that was being paid.
As I understand your opponent's position, they claim that this study, first of all, was not constructed to identify discrimination in pay, but simply to identify those individuals whose compensation needed a second look, in effect, to make sure it was not discriminatory. So if is that correct? And if it is correct, how relevant and probative is the study standing alone?
The primary purpose of the study was to see if gender or discrimination did exist within IEPY in terms of pay, if there was a salary disparity. I would ask the court to look at Professor Carlin's deposition transcript. And Professor Carlin himself said that there was a statistically significant gap between the salaries, and that gender could not be ruled out as the reason for this gap. Dean Salkman, one of the things that, after one was picked as an outlier, as my client was, Dr. Coleman, being more than one standard deviation below a predicted salary, Dean Salkman, the deans would have a committee review that particular individual to see how their productivity was, and to look at their journals, to look at their writings. And the committee here strongly recommended an increase. There's evidence in the record that shows that ideally Dean Salkman was supposed to have questions posed to this committee about gender and inequity and whether discrimination existed due to these salaries. I see that I'm almost out of time. If I can just finish up one more thought for the same sum for rebuttal, was that Dean Salkman told Dr. Coleman and his supervisors that he had in fact moved her to the predicted salary. And he did not do so. He moved her one standard deviation below, which was a difference of approximately $8,000 or $9,000 from what she should have been made. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. We'll hear now from Ms. Tadler.
And Your Honors, may I please the court. I'm Susan Tadler, here on behalf of the trustees of Indiana University. In this matter, as noted by Mr. Fox, this is a situation in which claims are made of sex discrimination under both the Equal Pay Act and the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. But both of those claims have to fail unless Dr. Cullen can identify a comparable person, a person who works in an environment with the same skills and experience and responsibilities and is paid more.
Then you disagree with Mr. Fox that the pay equity study in itself would not be sufficient?
I certainly do, Your Honor.
Could you tell us why, please?
Certainly. This pay equity study was never designed to be a predictor or an indicator of sex discrimination. It was simply a good faith methodology process undertaken by Indiana University as a first step to lead to, as you noted before, the individualized analyses as to whether blacks and whites, men and women, are sort of in the same general range. It certainly was not a precise or scientific study, nor was it ever intended to be. Many important factors in academia were not included as controls in this study.
Such as?
Marketplace. Productivity. Prestige of the program. Ineffables. There are so many ineffables in academia anyway affecting salaries. Academia is a world in which, let's face it, there's no science to the salaries. There are vagaries in all the salaries based on numerous factors, but those factors couldn't be controlled for. And in fact, the first outcome, the one which Mr. Fox refers to as showing the statistically significant disparity, was the growth study. It did not take into account the many important factors. Then there were individualized studies conducted, which resulted in this predicted salary for each person, from which then there was to be the departmental review. Notable in terms of any inference of sex discrimination, and of course, Dr. Carlin was simply asked, can you rule out sex? And he said, well, no. But he wasn't asked, well, can you rule out department, prestige of the department? Can you rule out? There were lots of things he couldn't rule out, but he wasn't asked that. He was just asked sex. And of course, any statistician said, well, no, I can't rule out. The sun might not come out tomorrow morning. But quite significantly, in terms of any inference of sex discrimination, is the fact that this study utilized only a one standard deviation for identifying people who would warrant a further review. In the Rautenbusch case that we submitted as a supplemental matter here, citations are made to two Supreme Court cases involving statistics. One is Gay versus Waiters and Longshoremen Union. The other is Hazelwood, in which the Supreme Court states that you can't even begin to think about an inference of sex discrimination unless you're talking about people below two standard deviations. Dr. Cullen was never a two standard deviation. She was below one, but way above two. So in terms of the study, its purpose was not to identify sex discrimination. It was a rather crudely done study, only meant to allow a process for individualized scrutiny. And that's what occurred here.
No good deed ever goes unpunished, does it?
That was exactly my statement I wanted to make. You got it. They've learned their lesson.
Yeah, I anticipate things.
Thank you so much. Getting back to the comparable, Dr. Quillen, as was aptly noted in Mr. Fox's statement, Dr. Quillen's job clearly involved greater responsibilities than that of Dr. Cullen. For numerous reasons, but you have to start with the premise. Note that for the first 8 years of her employment, Dr. Cullen never complained that she should have been paid the same as the director of the physical therapy program, who was the female, Constance McCloy. There was a large disparity between their salaries. But Dr. Cullen never said, well, that's unfair, that's discriminatory, nor could she, because it was a female. By the way, there were two other female program directors.
Well, she could always claim it was unfair.
Excuse me?
Being unfair and being discriminatory are two different things. She could always claim it was unfair.
Well, she didn't even voice that. She probably felt it. But there were also two other female program directors in the School of Allied Health Sciences who were paid more than Dr. Cullen. The head of the occupational therapy department, who was only an associate professor, only had a master's degree, but she was receiving more than $70,000 at the time that Colin was receiving $62,000. And Linda Casper, the medical technology school director, also an associate professor, also only a master's degree, was receiving almost $66,000 when Dr. Colvin was receiving $62,000, and so forth. Therefore, she knew that programs were weighted and valued differently regardless of gender.
How do you handle this situation with the radiology department?
Well, the radiology department, what we don't know there, we don't know a lot of things about that. We don't know how many students it had. We don't know how many programs it had. We don't know what kind of degree it offered. And we don't know what the history was of whoever got there. But again, there are always going to be inequities and vagaries. But the point is, does it have anything to do with gender? No. But let's focus on Dr. Quillen, because that's her named identifier. And let's focus on the physical therapy program vis-a-vis the respiratory therapy program. It was noted before that not only did Dr. McCoy, the predecessor, make $85,000, and Dr. Quillen was brought in at $90,000, but Dr. Quillen was brought in at $90,000 a year later. Dr. McCoy had left in the early 97 school year, and she also took some faculty, which created an even greater crisis. Here we have a physical therapy department, the linchpin of the entire school, the source, greatest source of the revenue for that school. And regardless of what Mr. Fox says, the evidence is undisputed that even with this $150,000 additional monies that Dr. Colin presumably brought in from Clarion Health, her department still operated at a deficit. And therefore, that arrearage had to be funded somewhere else, and it was funded out of the linchpin program of physical therapy, which brought in the most revenue because it had the greatest number of students and other factors that resulted in income. If Dr. McCoy had stayed and had received the same percentage increase for the next school year, which would have been the 98-99 school year, her salary would have been almost $89,000. Dr. Quillen was brought in at that time at $90,000, $1,000 more than would a female have had if Dr. McCoy had remained in the position and had not created the crisis. But the reality is the position that Dr. McCoy had as director of physical therapy was not the position that Dr. Quillen was brought in to do. It's already acknowledged that from the disparity between McCoy and Colin that the program is worth more as a general proposition. But look what happened in 1998. Dr. Quillen was brought in to save not only the physical therapy department, but by extension, the entire School of Allied Health Sciences, because without that department, the whole school would have collapsed. So what he had to do, and it was in the record on page 221, his hiring letter makes clear, your primary duty will be to direct all aspects of the physical therapy program pertaining to personnel, budget, and curriculum. This includes, but is not limited to, the recruitment of new faculty. Remember, McCoy took some of the faculty, so they were operating short. Curricular redesign to move to a Master of Physical Therapy degree and appropriate communication with the accrediting bodies. That department was on probation at that time. It was not any short staff. It did not have a graduate program as required by the accrediting body for physical therapy. He had to come in, get that program in place, get the right faculty in place, which is why his credentials are fabulous. He has a PhD in his area. It needed somebody of that caliber to come in and create this graduate program for the School of Allied Health Sciences. And he did it. It wasn't that it was an onerous task, additional for him, to write letters to the students. I don't care who wrote the letters to the students. It was the import of that school having to write letters to students saying, we are now on probation and we could lose our accreditation. And these students were in the program or wanting to come into the program. Well, obviously, as a recruitment tool, that was a disaster. And for the students there, the liability, if they didn't get accredited after putting in all that time, the disgruntled parents had spent all that money, it was a woeful picture. And that's the icing on the cake. It was a big icing. And it resulted in a $1,000 difference over what his female predecessor would have got. In terms of market forces, IU was blessed to be able to get Dr. Quillett at $90,000. It was almost what his previous salary had been. He had absolute wonderful credentials for the position. Very few people applied for this opening. It was submitted nationwide. Well, who wanted to walk into this morass? Not a whole lot of long-term job security either if you couldn't get that graduate program in place. By the way, he did all that. He was worth $90,000 and beyond. Notable also, at that same time as Dr. Quillen was brought in at $90,000, a female associate professor in the Department of Physical Therapy named Joyce McKinnon was brought in at $95,000. Now, she had a dual capacity. She's also going to be the associate dean. But she was a female, paid more than Quillen, came in at the same time. Yeah, she had a responsibility above and beyond just being in the classroom. He had a responsibility above and beyond just being a director of an ongoing, stable program. His circumstances were unique. And that differential doomed Dr. Cullen's entire case. We're not talking about did they both have desks, did they both have to do budgets, did they both have, you know, a curriculum to develop. How many students do they have, all that. That was the differential that existed with McCoy, and it was obviously legitimate and certainly not sex discriminatory. But then you add these additional responsibilities for Quillen, and the whole house of cards has to fail. Certainly, there's no evidence in the record that this Dr. Softman harbored any animus towards females that would have resulted in intentional discrimination. He hired a lot of females. We just talked about hiring McKinnon at more money than Dr. Quillen. He paid some other female directors making more than Dr. Quillen. Three at the time that Dr. McCoy left. There were three female directors making more than she did. He gave higher salary adjustments to females, and particularly to this female, Dr. Cullen. She was the only outlier in the study, the only outlier in the School of Allied Health Sciences who was given an increase by Dr. Softman. And by the way, in terms of comparables, the only comparable in terms of that pay equity study, whatever importance it's supposed to have in this case, would be male outliers, and by the way, the majority of the outliers were male, who were in fact raised to the predicted salary. Nowhere in the record is any such individual ever identified. There is no evidence that any males were ever raised to the predicted salary. Indeed, the evidence is that most of the males who were outliers received no adjustment at all. And that was true of the other two outliers who were male in the School of Allied Health Sciences. So discrimination on the basis of sex has not been Dr. Cullen's problem. Her problem has been her field is respiratory therapy and not something else. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Sir, you have 1 minute, 30 seconds. What about Ms. Tabler's point that as a result of the pay equity study, the record does not show that any male did better than Dr. Cullen?
In the record, there is a breakdown in terms of who was reviewed and who received a review. And I'm not sure that exactly states that specifically. I will say, though, that in terms of the two males that were identified in the School of Allied Health Sciences were that department, one resigned before the review, so that was never an issue. And the other one, the committee did not recommend an increase. Now, in our case, Dr. Coleman was recommended an increase by the committee. She had the highest productivity rating. They strongly recommended that. And in fact, another female, Mary Ann Schurig, the committee also recommended an increase for her, but Dean Saltzman said no. In fact, he was the only dean in the entire school that ever said no to one of their committee's recommendations, and that is on the record, and that is clear. With regard to the pay equity study, this study did include market factors. It did include merits. It did include productivity. It is distinguishable from Rudebush in that manner. Further, if we're going to talk about graduate degrees, then one would have to look at the occupational therapy program, which also has a graduate degree. Dr. Cecil Hammett runs that program, yet she makes $20,000 less per year than Dr. Quillen. And finally, the increase that, I'm sorry, I see that I'm out of time.
Finish your thought.
The increase that Dean Saltzman said he gave the committee was he said he moved her to the predicted salary. When we're talking about intent, he did not move her to the predicted. He moved her one standard deviation and told his superiors that he had done so. Thank you very much for your time, Your Honor.
The court would like to thank both Mr. Fox and Ms. Tablett for their fine presentation.